Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and I've got a great new book for you today on the show. Brandon Keim is the author. He's a freelance journalist, author of the book Meet the Neighbors, Animal, and the subtitle, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. Fascinating book. He says we're surrounded by evidence of animal intelligence, and humans don't have that market cornered, and makes a case for looking at the animals in our neighborhood as neighbors rather than perhaps as interlopers, you might say. And full of fascinating stories and research about animals that make decisions, who are certainly intelligent. And as we talk with Brandon, I hope you'll join in. Have you experienced what you feel are very smart and intelligent wild animals in your neighborhood or somewhere? Do you look at them as your neighbors? Maybe, maybe not. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Brandon Keim, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Larry. I'm real glad to be here.
Well, I tell you what, I found your book fascinating and enjoyed. It's also written very well. kept me on my toes throughout and interested throughout the whole thing as you talked about intelligence and in animals and your neighborhood. I loved the. Well, I first loved the little insert preface with Fiona Presley and her wounded bumblebee. And I guess we could probably get into that, and maybe we will. But I really enjoyed how you took your neighborhood and talked about the animals in your neighborhood, and maybe you should describe that whole process.
Well, sure. The first several chapters of the book are basically a walk around a fairly typical Eastern North American neighborhood. It was in Bethesda, Maryland, and
you had a cool stormwater pond.
And a great stormwater retention pond. You know, there's so much infrastructure out there that's just full of nature or has the possibility to be full of nature. And that's not narrowly a point about animal intelligence, but I just want to say, if you are managing a stormwater retention pond and you've got that grass mowed down to, you know, within an inch of its life all around the edges, please consider doing some restoration with native wildflowers and creating some habitat. So in the first several chapters, you know, I'm walking around my neighborhood in Bethesda, Maryland, and I'm looking at the animals I encounter there sort of, you know, through the lens of research on scientific research on the intelligence of animals. And, you know, kind of the genesis of that section. You know, as you mentioned, so I'm a science journalist, and, you know, back in the, you know, early 2010s, really throughout that decade, I was really writing a lot about the science of animal intelligence. And originally I thought, you know, my book was going to be just about that, you know, just about these findings of snakes having relationships and bumblebee emotions and, you know, self-awareness being distributed throughout the animal kingdom and not just a few extra smart creatures. But over time, I really became, you know, even much more interested in the question of what we do with these insights. And so that broadly is really, you know, what Meet the Neighbors is about. But that first section is still kind of, you know, the distilled form of that original book that I was thinking about writing. And what I wanted to accomplish that, you know, is, you know, I think I see news stories about animal intelligence all the time. You know, this study found this and that study found that. And it can kind of feel abstracted to me in that presentation, you know, like these findings are just, you know, happening on the pages of scientific journals or in labs, and you get all these, you know, really complicated, you know, you get down into the weeds of the methodology of each individual study. I just wanted to make that research come alive and really put it out there on the landscape. Anybody's neighborhood is a great place to do that, because wherever you are, you step out the door and there are going to be animals all around you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Scott in Iron River has some animals around him. Let's go there for a minute. Scott, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes, absolutely. Nice to be on. I'm thrilled about your work. And my wife and I have a place out in the woods in the Iron River area. And we just kind of coexist with the squirrels and chipmunks. And they run around on our deck, and they don't bother us. We don't bother them. And I guess I just have a general question about behavior with squirrels and chipmunks, but also in relation to bird feeders, that I'm very happy to say I haven't had a squirrel on my feeder in 2 years. and I've used strategies that do not involve firearms. And I just have such admiration for their ingenuity and intelligence. And I looked at it as a challenge, a respectful challenge, that I'm happy to stand currently winning the battle, but the war will go on, but the battle is in my favor right now. So any comments in regard to that, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. Oh, man. Brandon, comment.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Jeff. Oh my goodness, there's so much to say. We could just spend the next hour talking about squirrels, and really just about the strategies that we all have found to keep squirrels from dominating the bird feeder. I'm curious to hear what you, Vaiga. I've figured out some sort of pull and baffle and like multiple stages of challenges that seems to have worked, except when the snow gets too deep. You know, first of all, it's just really great to hear, you know, that attitude you have towards, you know, the squirrels and chipmunks right outside your door. And, you know, that it's such a simple thing, right? And yet it's so profound, this idea of just, you know, coexisting peacefully with the creatures around us. And when there's some tension, then you find a way to resolve it that doesn't involve killing, doesn't involve relocating, you know, it just involves trying to modify our own behaviors in a way that, you know, allows space for everybody. And so that's really good to hear. And, you know, I just say on the topic of squirrels, first of all, the epigraph for my book involves squirrel, and it comes from a paper by an anthropologist named Barbara Smuts, who did some extraordinary work on baboons or with baboons in the 1980s. And she was basically living with them, living with a community of baboons. And it just gave her really a new insight into just how rich and complex the lives of wild animals are. And then she also talks in that paper about the relationship she had with her dog, which, you know, of course, nothing more needs to be said. You know, the relationships we have with our dogs are often so profound. There is such a deep communication, whether or not, you know, there's spoken language involved. And then kind of the light went on for her, and she thought, wait a second, you know, it's every animal out there is an individual and is a somebody. And she kind of had this illumination, you know, looking at a squirrel, which I think is so appropriate because they're so common and just such exceptional creatures.
I sit on my front porch as much as I can. And I read books for the show. I'm usually, you know, in this kind of weather, I'm sitting out on the front porch, and there's a squirrel there. And I have lots of flowers that are in ground, but I also have some pots. And there's one pot, it's kind of a long pot. And the squirrel, the same guy, kept digging up one end. And I would put new flowers in, and he would dig up the one end again. And the other flowers, he'd leave. And so finally I thought, well, why am I putting more flowers in here? So I quit. And then I was sitting out yesterday, and I realized why he was doing this, because he came over, and he's gotten used to me because I'm out on that front porch a lot. And he came over, and he had a black walnut.
There you go.
And he went over to he looked at me he knew I wasn't going to chase after him. And then he went over to that pot, which is kind of a long rectangular pot, and stuck the walnut in the pot.
Covered it.
And he wanted that end. He wanted that end of the pot. So I just left it there. I was glad I hadn't kept putting more flowers in that end.
Makes you wonder, why was it that one spot? What was it that, made that so appealing to him? And I just want to get in there, apropos of that story that, which I really love. It's really extraordinary when you think about it. So right now, I'm sitting at the edge of a mature forest, and there's lots of seed and cone bearing trees in there that squirrels love. And when you stop and think about it, squirrels probably planted most of those trees, right? They did something, they buried the nut, they buried, and forgot about where it was, or maybe they got eaten first, it didn't get a chance to go back to it. And it kind of blows my mind to look out at this forest and think of it not as something that just kind of, sprung into being spontaneously, but that it was really created and produced, by the activity of multitudes of animals, including the squirrels who planted the seeds that grew into the trees. And I kind of like to think about, okay, thanks for the forest, squirrel. So what do I owe you in return, right?
Yesterday, I interviewed Jennifer Holland. She has a book out. It's called Dog Smart, Life-Changing Lessons in Canine Intelligence. And we talked about intelligence in dogs yesterday. And you talk about, obviously, about intelligence and come kind of compare with instinct a bit and talk about research in that area and do it in a delightful way. But how, and you demonstrate and maybe talk about how animals think, feel, and behave in ways that suggest they have intelligence other than squirrels. I mean, all of the animals, they have ways to communicate. They have ways to be intelligent, but talk about that.
Well, that is a very big topic, but it's good. My goodness, I'm ready to talk about squirrels for the next 45 minutes. Let me reroute a little bit. So first of all, let me just say that, the science, the way that our ideas about animal intelligence have evolved across, the last couple of millennia. And when I say our, I'm, talking about, sort of people coming from, the Western European or kind of the Enlightenment tradition of knowledge. And, of course, there are a great many other ontologies out there, especially, indigenous, pretty much every indigenous ontology that I've ever heard of, that all regard other animals as thinking, feeling beings, with whom we really share a lot in common on the inside. But the particular knowledge tradition that that prevailed and that is kind of the way that most of us are socialized is that what came out of quote unquote the West, and you can look back at the last 2,000 years, more than that, start off with Aristotle, who asserted that animals are really only capable of feeling pain and hunger. You know, and he's responsible for kind of, you know, having a taxonomic arrangement of animals with, you know, with humans on top and a hierarchy of animals below that described not only their relationships to one another anatomically, but also created kind of a moral and intellectual hierarchy as well. You know, you can trace a line from that on through medieval Christian theologians who were just really bent on replacing pagan, you know, quote unquote, pagan ideas about the commonality between humans and animals with an idea of human exceptionalism and what it is that set us apart from other creatures, which, you know, they seized upon our minds and our rationality and our ability to speak and so on as being, you know, as being what, quote unquote, made us human and therefore different. You know, and then on to, you know, René Descartes and the scientists and philosophers of the Enlightenment, you know, who, you know, Descartes famously compared animals to, to mechanical wind-up toys, right? You know, they move and they give the appearance of life, but it's all just springs and clockwork. You know, and then go on through that to the, you know, to the science of the early 20th century, which really laid down the legacy that we're kind of digging out from now. And all across that time, you do have many people pushing back and saying, wait a second, animals are very intelligent. You know, they have a lot going on in there, you know, but that side lost. And so basically throughout much of the 20th century, the conventional scientific wisdom was that, you know, animals are just not meaningfully intelligent. And now, of course, in everyday life, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, ways that people know that that's not the case and say, oh, wait a second, well, I've got a cat or a dog, I'm a farmer, I know my horses and my cows. You know, these are obviously very intelligent, sensitive creatures. So it's not like that idea was ever fully extinguished, you know, but it wasn't serious. You could kind of push back against it and call it anthropomorphic. And it was easy to kind of turn it off, right? So now I grew up in a world where, yeah, I recognize the intelligence of my cats and dogs, but somehow the idea that every squirrel out there, every wild animal out there, you know, is also meaningfully intelligent is kind of this conventional wisdom overturning proposition. So all that is the history. And but now, you know, now we really are just in this wonderful moment of scientific research into animal minds, and there's so many great studies, but a few of my favorite, this is more than a decade now, but there are a group of researchers, their names are escaping me. I'm going to say Melissa Bateson. I hope I didn't get that wrong, but so they were studying the emotions of bumblebees or the feelings of bumblebees, mm-hmm. and they used what are called cognitive bias tests, and you know, that's could get down into the weeds on the experimental details, but basically it comes down to, you know, do you see the glasses half full or half empty? And for humans, if you're in a good mood, it's half full. If you're in a bad mood, it's probably half empty. And you can kind of replicate that with bees, not by presenting them with a glass half full of water, but by giving them, you know, let's say training them to expect a sugary reward if they press a green button, and or, you know, mm-hmm. yeah, or, you know, get a bitter reward if they, you know, press the red button. And then so you give them a color that's halfway in between. Now, are they going to press that button? Are they going to take the chance that it's sweet and not bitter? And if they're in a good mood, they'll take that chance. And so, you know, just using that really clever methodology, she was able to get at the experiences of bumblebees and how they're, you know, their kind of momentary emotional states of being stressed or feeling good played out across time and became what we would call moods. You know, they're happy, mm-hmm. they're sad, they're in a good mood, they're in a bad mood. And, you know, there's just something about, you know.
I thought that was so fascinating.
I mean, you look at a bumblebee.
I thought
it was so fascinating. You know, they're so different than us. Oh, yeah, as you can see, so different than us, and yet there is that core fundamental similarity.
If they're in a good mood, they'll take that in the middle color. And if they're not in a good mood, maybe not. They're going to do something else. Well, we're going to keep going on this, yeah. Brandon. Thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll continue to be with us. Brandon Keim, last name is spelled K-E-I-M, and his book is Meet the Neighbors, subtitle Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking today with author Brandon Keim. His book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. At noon today, by the way, we'll talk with two rehabilitators of Native Wisconsin Wildlife in Oconomowoc. And then at 12:30, some DNR research scientist shares what was learned from a study of 68 collared coyotes in southern Wisconsin. So we have all that coming up. But right now, Meet the Neighbors. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Martha in Menominee will give you a chance to join in. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Larry, this is really fun. I have a crow that visits my peanuts that I throw out for him. I've named him Dewey Crow after the character in the series Justified because he's a little bit of a rogue. Anyway, I'm wondering if your guest has read this book called Gifts of the Crow. It's by John Marchleff and Tony Angel, and it talks about how crows can identify facial features of humans. It's a really good book, and I'm wondering if, besides your guest's book, and this book, if there's any others that he can recommend about crows.
You talk about crows. I mean, you talk about crows and really some fascinating research on crows and actually rats, too, who can remember things, recognize patterns, yeah, and solve problems. Amazing.
So crows in particular. So, you know, John Marchleff is, he's out there, I believe it's in Washington, and I reference some of his work in the book. He does fascinating stuff, and I'm trying to think of other books about crows specifically. Of course, there's Bernd Heinrich's book about ravens, which not the same thing as crows, but there's going to be some overlap there. And there's a guy named Thomas Van Doren. He's a sort of environmental historian and theorist who has written a lot of just really deeply thoughtful works about many animals. But he has written about corvids as well. And I can't remember if it's a book or a chapter in a book, but if you look up Thomas Van Doren, D-O-O-R-E-N, you'll find that and some other work of his as well, and you won't be disappointed. And, you know, I would also just toss into the mix. So one of the things that I, you know, talk about in my book is really over the last 10 or 20 years or so, you know, it's not just the science of animal intelligence that has flourished, but all sorts of scholarship about animals. There's been something in the humanities that's called the quote unquote the animal turn, which is just basically, you know, all of these, you know, historians and anthropologists and social scientists and literary theorists and what have you, you know, really turning their attention to animals in a meaningful way. And just the scholarship that's come out of that, you know, it can be kind of wonky and academic, but there's just so many interesting ideas out there. And if you just kind of hop on, you know, Google Scholar and, you know, type in crow animal studies or something like that, you'll find so much interesting, thinking about crows that is really building on the science and kind of saying, okay, well, you know what, what do we do with this now? We have this sense of crows as being intelligent and being somebodies and being beings who are out there in the world. So kind of where do we go from there? And it's interesting stuff.
Yeah, Martha. And be sure to take a look at Brandon's book, Meet the Neighbors, as well, because there's a lot on crows and rats in there. You know, and you do have some really interesting research on crows and discussions on them. you know, there, it's, I wouldn't say easy, but it's easier to study animals' traits like intelligence, learned behavior, than, say, emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, emotions, you know, emotions are difficult to study in human beings, much less animals. And at least with humans, you know, I can tell you how I feel, and that's not always the case with animals. You know, and this is starting to change, but there's still really a long way to go. And I think this is, you know, something to keep in mind is that, you know, all these creatures out there on the landscape, you know, they're not just intelligent in the sense of, you know, remembering things and being able to solve problems and, you know, planning for the future and what have you, you know, but they also have an emotional, you know, their intelligence also encompasses emotions. They're also feeling. And I mentioned that, of course, with bumblebee emotions being a great example. But, you know, right now, one of the things I love to do in fall, as I'm sure many of your listeners do, you know, is just be aware of the fall migration, right? These great rivers, birds who are, you know, flying overhead and stopping on by as they make their way south. And that's usually something that's understood, you know, as a, you know, an extraordinary physiological accomplishment, a great feat of navigation. But you don't often sort of think about, you know, the emotional experience of flying 4,000 miles from the boreal forest to South America. And there are a few scientists who have started, you know, to study now just the social relationships of migrating groups of birds. And one of my favorite studies comes from some biologists who tracked the migrations of a species called European bee eaters. And so they make these flights from, you know, from Western and Central Europe all the way to equatorial Africa. And what the researchers found is that they're making those flights, you know, with friends and family, right? Those, you know, those groups stay together that whole time. And if they get separated, then they, you know, usually reunite with one another at the end, you know. But if, you know, of course the researchers aren't studying how that feels, but you can just imagine, you know, how happy you are, like, to see your mate after, you know, after you've been separated and reunited 4,000 miles away. And, you know, there's just such a resonance to adding emotions onto all the other forms of intelligence we recognize in animals.
And you do write about some research there was on birds in flight. I don't know if it was geese, but they have a method of conversing. Their songs, and I mean, that's their language, but they can talk among themselves as they fly about who's going to go first, or, you know, or do we need to change, or what direction do we go? I thought that was really fascinating.
Oh, it's, you know, the, so I guess maybe I grew up sort of thinking of, you know, groups of animals. You've got a leader, you know, usually he's going to be the key. Notice I said he is going to be the biggest and the strongest and, you know, animal of all. But there are so many species, including, you know, many bird species, who, you know, their leadership, you know, they're not just dominated by a leader. They are collectively making decisions about who to follow and what to do. And pigeons are a really interesting example of this, where, you know, you see a flock of pigeons flying overhead. You know, they'll be following a leader, but their leader can change. And, you know, if the leader isn't, you know, doesn't seem to have very good knowledge of the route they're following, you know, they'll say, okay, we're going to follow somebody else here, right? And, you know, how that is sort of, you know, worked out on the fly, I think, is still something people are figuring out. But there are examples with geese deciding whether to take off. And, you know, the way that they vote through honking, right? And when the frequency of honks in the groups reaches a certain intensity, then that's when they say, okay, all right, fine, we'll go. And then they take off, you know, as a group. And yeah, animal communication, there are just still there's so much to learn, but you know, but hey, if you're following the bird migration, you're out there at night and you can hear the birds passing overhead, and you just hear those calls, those contact calls they make to each other, keeping in touch, letting each other know who's who, you know, coming down out of the night sky towards you at this time of year. It's a special thing.
Jeff in Duluth, Minnesota has something about conversations and talking, I believe. Jeff, hi.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Yes, I am in Duluth, but we have a cabin in northwestern Wisconsin on Lake Minnesowing, and I have a comment that kind of evolves into a question. A couple of months ago, we were sitting on our deck, and we heard the loons start calling, which fairly common for us, still unique and fun to hear. But what would respond surprised all of us, and we had more than one witness to this, was some sort of canine creature. Could have been a wolf, could have been a coyote, could have even been a dog. But this went on three rounds of three. So the loon would call, the canine would respond, the loon would call, the canine would respond. I mean, it was really a call and response kind of episode. I've never heard of it before. None of my friends have ever heard of it before. In fact, some of my friends look at me like I'm very strange. But I'm wondering if the guest has ever heard of such a thing. Because you have now, because I swear to God it happened.
Jeff, thank you for calling. What do you think, Brandon?
Wow, I've heard of that now. That is an amazing story. What a treat. What a privilege to hear that.
I've never heard of it either, and it's really a cool thing to have heard. I am sure of that, Jeff. Karen in Madison, we'll go to you and then to Rachel. Karen, hi.
Hi. I've got a quick story. It's kind of sad, but there was a crow in my yard that got caught in a woven wire fence. I didn't realize it until it had been there a while and was flapping around. So I was heartbroken, and I went out with gloves, and I was speaking softly and trying to save it, but unfortunately, when I finally got it untangled from the fence, it died in my hands, and I was heartbroken. But it had its whole family was around, and they came down and swooped around me and were circling me as I was holding this crow, and were calling, and they weren't dive bombing me, but they were. You know, circling above my head. And so I put the body of the crow down on a rock in my backyard and went back inside and just watched. And all afternoon, this whole flock of crows sat vigil over this body.
And you write about this in your book, Brandon, something similar.
Yeah. So thank you for sharing that story. That's really powerful. Apropos of what we were talking about a moment ago with emotion. So there have been studies of how crows respond to the bodies of dead conspecifics, as it's called. And the way that the findings from those studies have been reported in the popular press is that, you know, crows, you know, what we call crow funerals is really just crows, you know, basically acquiring information about how that individual died, because that information could, you know, be really very relevant to their own lives. And, you know, and that's unquestionably seems to be the case. But, you know, there is also that other dimension of, you know, the social bonds and the emotional response. And, you know, that's not something that the researchers are trying to measure. It's on their minds, but they're not sure how to go about it in an ethical way. And, you know, and so that's really not part of the research. And then the way that the findings get reported is just, you know, sort of all about information acquisition and, you know, nothing about, you know, emotions or the idea of grief or, you know, acknowledging the passing of death. And yeah, you know, that is just such powerful example of it. Thank you.
Karen, thank you. Rachel in Eau Claire, thank you for waiting.
Hi. I wanted to bring up beavers and their engineering prowess. I took a wildlife ecology course when I was in college, and our task was to doing a project on estimating the beaver population in Itasca State Park in Minnesota. And so my partner and I were backcountry checking out every dam that we could find, and we found one dam that had been broken in the middle, and the beavers had repaired it by making a rectangle in front of the break. And we thought that was completely ingenious, because if you try to put a stick in the middle of a break, it's just gonna wash away. But I don't know a lot of humans who would have been able to figure that out. So my comment, and I will take your response off the air.
Thank you, Rachel. That's an example, and it's something you also write about, Brandon, in your book.
Yeah, so beavers figure prominently in a chapter about personhood, which you should buy the book and read that chapter. But just about the example you gave, what a really fun thing to be able to do, just roaming around looking at beaver dams. Oh my God, I would love to do that. And the example you gave, though, right? Like, that's something that, you know, not long ago, and even today, some people would still just say, oh, well, you know, beavers making dams, it's purely instinctive. You give a baby beaver a bunch of sticks, and they're probably going to try to, you know, stack them up, that there's no thought involved. And then you see something like that where, no, right? There is clearly thought. There is clearly an understanding of physical properties, and also probably techniques that have been developed over the course of a beaver's life, or even over multiple generations, because that knowledge is being passed on socially. And I'm not aware of any research on the cultural transmission of knowledge in beavers, and, you know, the cultural transmission of dam building and repairing techniques. But I would love for some scientists to get out there and study that, because I think, you know, there is a lot of research on animal culture now, but it tends to be more, you know, animals like elephants or chimpanzees, who are kind of recognized as being extremely intelligent and are also very long-lived. But I think, you know, cultural transmission is happening all the time. Also, you know, and cultural bodies of knowledge are accumulating all the time, also in animals like beavers and other creatures who we don't usually think of through that lens. So if there are any researchers listening to this, please do that study.
Cultural knowledge. I was remembering a couple of things about beavers, but I was reminded of birds and a study you reported on that was done a long time ago of, I don't know if it was really a study, but there were some birds, a certain bird, and this is back in 1930s or something, that in one town learned to take the caps off of milk jugs that were sitting on people's front porch.
Mm-hmm.
And then
go
ahead.
Yeah, it was in the town of Swathing, England, is where it started. And this is kind of, you know, one of the landmark studies of cultural transmission in animals. And you know, because bird watchers in general, and then especially British bird watchers, are very rigorously observant people, there were records of this behavior occurring, you know, first in Swathing, and then in the towns nearby, and then the towns around them. And so, you know, by watching how this behavior progressed across the landscape, you know, then it was clear that these birds were learning from each other, right? It wasn't just, you know, like they all figured out how to do it at the same time or in some sequential way. And they were popping the tops. Well, I guess some of your listeners are going to be young enough that this won't make sense to them without the explanation that once upon a time, yeah. milk was delivered in bottles left on people's doorsteps. And in between the moment the delivery man dropped it off and the homeowner opened the door and brought the milk inside, birds would have a chance to pop the tops off the bottles and get at the milk themselves.
Amazing story. One of the amazing stories that Brandon Keim talks about in his book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Lives, Animal Minds, and Life in a More Than Human World. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Brandon Keim about his book, Meet the Neighbors, subtitle Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. Brandon, you write about one, you have many things we haven't talked about yet in your book. One of them was the Non-Human Rights Project, which I think was founded in 2007, perhaps, somewhere in there, by Stephen Weiss.
That's right, somewhere in there. And, you know, Stephen, who passed away earlier this year, is, so he was an animal rights attorney, and he came to believe that, you know, really the great fundamental problem that he was, you know, fighting against is that animals are considered property in the eyes of the law. There's no such thing as of now in the United States as an animal who is truly considered a person. And by person, I mean, in this context, an entity capable of bearing rights. And sometimes when people write about the Non-Human Rights Project, they'll say stuff like, oh, you know, should animals have the same rights as humans? And Steve would always say, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, can animals have any rights at all? And the first right that he sought was for the right to be physically free, the right to bodily liberty, for captive chimpanzees in New York State. And then later on, what I wrote about, he and the Non-Human Rights Project filed a series of lawsuits on behalf of captive elephants, including an elephant named Happy, who is now captive at the Bronx Zoo in New York. And, you know, something that I think was really compelling and powerful about the case that Stephen called into being is that, you know, he was appealing to the bedrock principles of Western democracy and Western civilization, and saying, listen, you know, if the science shows, in the case of chimpanzees and then elephants, that they possess all of the qualities that we consider important for autonomy, so that they're self-aware, they reflect upon the past, they think upon the future, you know, they live in complex societies, communicating with one another, and following cultural norms. You know, everything that we say, well, this is, you know, if human beings do these things, then we need to treat them as people. And, you know, really a fundamental right of a human being is a right not to be arbitrarily imprisoned. Well, you know, if you have an animal who meets all those criteria, then why shouldn't we say that is a person with the right to be free as well? And, you know, really the arguments against that logic come down to, well, because it's complicated, meaning if you grant personhood to a chimpanzee or an elephant, then pretty soon people will be asking for personhood for pigs and chickens. And rather than having a grown-up conversation about that, let's just sweep it under the rug and not even say that chimps or elephants can be people. You know, the rejection will just come in the form of, well, because they're animals, right? It's you know, that's fundamentally what it's about. Rights are for humans. Animals are not human. Therefore, animals can't have rights. You know, and what Steve would always say is, you know, that type of thinking where you just have some arbitrary difference that basically amounts to they look different than us, and it's not in our interest to respect their rights, that always goes to bad places in human contexts. And something that was just so impressive to me is that, you know, these ideas, I think really they appeal to our better angels. And so many people were interested and are interested in the Non-Human Rights Project, you know, who are not animal rights people, who eat animals, but, you know, but those ideas are so powerful and so compelling that, you know, you just, that they're really worth thinking through. And I think the Non-Human Rights Project has just done an extraordinary job of articulating that.
You use an example, I guess it may be the only example in the country, of New York City that has an Office of Animal Rights.
Yes. You know, so sort of the next step up from thinking of animals as persons, whether it's in a legal sense or just in an everyday way, right? Like there's all sorts of situations in which, you know, personhood isn't about legal rights. It's just about how we treat one another. But the next step up from that, you know, is thinking about representation for animals in the institutions where decisions are made that affect their lives. And, you know, that's the essence of democracy, right? If you're affected by something, then you get a voice in the decision. And the way that New York has put this, you know, this principle into action is just by having somebody in the mayor's office whose job it is to talk to other people in government or people in the community, you know, about animal issues and to try to advocate on behalf of animals when decisions that are being made about them. And this isn't a person, you know, as of now, they don't have a voting capacity. There is not an animal representative on New York City Council, but I love to imagine what that would look like.
But they have had successes. I mean, just what
they have. I was just going to say, you know, finding ways of dealing with goose conflicts around the airport that, you know, involve just basically trying to get the geese away from the area and managing the habitat differently rather than just killing endless numbers of geese, using sterilization programs for deer on one of the islands where deer are really getting overpopulated and posing a traffic hazard. There's been some great advances with, you know, animal friendly bill design that, you know, that this office has pushed for. And it's just really cool to think that if you're a person in New York and you're concerned about animals in some way, maybe, you know, somebody's paving over a little pond in your neighborhood that, you know, the turtles use or something, you can call the Office of Animal Welfare. And there is somebody in government whose job it is, whose duty it is to advocate on behalf of the animals in New York City. And that's a cool thing.
It is a cool thing. And just to take it in a different area, and here we've only got about a minute or so to talk about it, but Brad Gates, who is in the animal removal business in homes, does it humanely.
Mm-hmm.
And has come up with ways that people like.
Yeah, he's the, you know, so Brad Gates, you know, he operates a company called AAA Wildlife Removal in Toronto, Ontario. And he's kind of the, you know, the great grandfather of the whole field of humane wildlife removal and wildlife conflict resolution. And one of his innovations is that, you know, he takes a raccoon or a squirrel out of your attic, he just releases that raccoon or squirrel outside, right? Doesn't truck them off into the, you know, into the woods somewhere, into a place that, you know, the raccoon or the squirrel doesn't know and is probably going to die there. You know, he leaves them in the neighborhood, which is their home too, and then makes sure they can't get back into your house. And if I have time just to recount one anecdote, one of Brad's favorite stories involves a raccoon who he had to remove from somebody's garage. And so he gets there and the garage door is closed, right? And he can't figure out how the heck did this raccoon getting in the first place. And so he goes to catch the raccoon and the raccoon, you know, runs down one of the support beams, hits the automatic garage door opener button, waits for the garage door to open and then runs out. And it turns out
that's what he was doing.
Out, this raccoon. Every single night after everybody went to sleep, this raccoon would climb down, open the garage door, go out into the neighborhood, do their thing, then come back early in the morning, close the door before anybody woke up and even knew that anything had happened.
A great story and a great way to end. Brandon Keim, thank you so much for being with us today. His book, Meet the Neighbors, Animal Minds and Life in a More Than Human World. We haven't covered it all, believe me. Take a look at it. You're going to enjoy it. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.